Hello and welcome to Avi's Conversational Corner, a podcast on history, culture, and politics in a broad perspective. I am your host, Avi Wolf. You can find this and other episodes like it on Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, and YouTube, and you can help support the podcast through Patreon. It was a time of rapid, terrifying, and exhilarating change, a time of scientific breakthroughs, mass politics, endless scandals, and efforts at reform. A time when new groups of Americans fought for and sometimes won their right to participate fully in American life, while others did their best to try and keep America as it was, or as they imagined it to be, with few heroes, many villains, great geniuses, and piercing questions, many of which still trouble us today. Welcome to Stumbling Colossus, a regular part of Avi's Conversational Corner, covering the Gilded and Progressive Ages of the United States, from the end of the Civil War to the end of the First World War. This episode's topic, the Golden Age of the Hated Railroads. If the Gilded Age built America, then railroads built the Gilded Age. Like the veins of a body, the rails connected the country's coasts, regions, small towns, and cities into an ever-integrated network of transportation, moving goods and people wherever they wanted to go. It forever changed how Americans perceived their country's geography and even how they measured time. A source of social mobility for many, it was also the largest source of employment in this era. Yet the railroads were also hated for their alleged abuses, monopolizing tendencies, and allegedly unfair rates, to the point that Americans grew to hate them just as they reached their peak. Why was this? How did railroads become the behemoth that did so much and was yet so low? And what led to the ultimate decline of this literally nation-building industry? With me today to discuss some of these questions and more is Christian Wolmar, a preeminent expert on railways in a global perspective and author, among many other books, of The Great Railway Revolution, The Epic Story of the American Railroad. Christian, welcome.
Very kind of you to have me.
Pleasure's all mine. So let me start with the question that I ask almost all my guests in this period. Let us imagine a British or European railway expert comes to visit the United States to check on and see the state of railroads in the budding United States at the end of the Civil War, say 1866-67, in the middle of our period in the 1890s, and at the end of our period after the First World War. What would they find? What would have changed? What would have stayed the same?
Whoa, that's a big question, because this was an era of amazing change. So by the end of the Civil War, there was something like 40,000 miles of railroad in the United States, very much with the better systems in the North than the South. The South had a very disconnected system, not very many big companies. The North had kind of major railroads companies that were able to expand quickly. And the mileage sort of doubled by the 1870s, doubled again, and we ended up with 200,000 or 250,000 miles of railroad at the end of your period, which actually happens to be the peak of the railroad system in the United States. So that's 250,000 miles across the country. And now there's a statistic that I told you about, and which I have to almost check every time that I kind of look at it and consider it. But if you divide the 250,000 miles with the start of the railway, which is 1830, and consider peak as 1916, and do the math, which is very simple, you end up with the amazing calculation that for every day of that period, that 86-year period, there were nearly 8 miles of railway opened every day, right, across the United States. And so if anything explains what you just said in your introduction about how the railways were so important and how they became this enormous kind of behemoth, that statistic tells it all. I mean, you know, so much resource, so much economic activity was devoted to the creation of the railroads, because of course they're not just you know, the two tracks running out into the distance, and the sleepers, the ties, as they're called in America, and the points, the switches, as you call them, and so on. There's also the stations. There's also the manufacturing of all the equipment, the signaling equipment, the locomotives, the carriages. There's the transport of both passengers and freight. These are enormous companies which have a fantastic impact on the development of United States economy and indeed of capitalism generally. I mean, my view, having written books about the Trans-Siberian railways, the British railways, the world's railways, all sorts of railways, is that they were the major catalyst for the spread of capitalism. So the period you're looking at is very interesting in that respect, because the Gilded Age, particularly the first part of it, was a glory time for the railways. They were expanding rapidly in the south. They were getting fixed and repaired from the damage of the Civil War. And in the north, they were spreading out to new land. So there were the Granger Railways, which were spreading out in the Midwest. And of course, the Transcontinental, the first one, which was completed in 1869, which many people won't know, was actually started work on during the Civil War in the West in 1863. But it was built with amazing speed, with lots of federal support. But that then in turn became a catalyst for the further expansion of the railroad network. By the end of your period, we have five transcontinental railways across the United States, another three across Canada, and of course, lots of branches and lines off there. So to answer your question, arriving in the 1860s, straight after the Civil War, one would have found a nascent railroad system that really didn't stretch much beyond St. Louis and Chicago, that it was expanding rapidly. It was becoming highly profitable because the development of the railways and the economy were symbiotic. And so people used the railways for lots of things, and they were making nice, healthy profits, which allowed them to invest further. There was support from the government for this expansion in many cases. Now, in your introduction, you kind of said the hated railways. I would kind of say it's a bit more ambivalent than that. I mean, certainly, initially, everybody liked the railways because they brought so much. They brought prosperity. They brought access to wider markets. You could order mail order goods by rail from the department stores, and they would dispatch them, to your rural home. They brought in all sorts of newfangled devices of the time that enabled people, labor saving devices and the like. So they were much in favor, and it was only towards maybe the middle of the period that you're looking at, where they began to be disliked. And I could go into reasons for that later. But so I think you have to be very careful about the negative aspect of them. There were many positive kind of parts of or feelings about the railroads, which didn't dissipate overnight.
Entirely fair. If we're on the subject, then before we get to the question of why the railroad was hated and why some people hated the railroad, whether it was fair, let's talk about passengers, because a lot of people associate railways with passengers, the Pullman cars, people being held up. Who took the railways in this period for travel? What for, and what was their experience like as this period went on?
Well, of course, it was a very mixed people. I think, again, it's very important to emphasize something that, and one has to emphasize this because it is difficult for 21st century people to understand that. There was no other way of getting around. There was no serious rival to the railways. Until the end of your period, until after the First World War, and we get the Model T and all that, and we begin to get a network of highways. So for the whole period that we're talking about, the railroads were the only way of getting around. So everybody used them. So at one end, there are, the third class coaches that were crammed with people using them. Maybe they were just the farmers going to market or to the local town. They were business people. There were, people traveling, immigrants particularly, that there were, there was no other way of kind of getting to work to the place where you were going to set up your home apart from on the railways. That the railways attracted these people deliberately. It was a kind of, they sent agents around Europe, kind of bringing in immigrants, and they were the facilitators for that, because they knew once they had people and brought them somewhere where there was a station, they were then a captive audience, and they would use the railways forever. So that was one end, and then the other end is the luxury end, where we have, again, in this period is a big development to this. We had Pullman cars. Now, they start kind of well before the First World War, sorry, the Civil War, but they then expanded rapidly. George Pullman, of course, is the main kind of promoter of these, but there's other cars as well, and those people travel in largely in some luxury, in comfortable coaches with very good meals. They pay quite a lot more, but it's still, very, very much kind of affordable. And they enjoy a standard of travel that is very different, but of course on the same tracks. Now, the American railways are different from the European railways in a couple of respects, in that they tended to be sometimes a bit slower, because they were built over long distances and somewhat on the cheap. So often they were built with curves to avoid kind of going up and down inclines. So you'd go around the mountain rather than through it. Very few tunnels on the American railroad system, and that pertains to this day. There's one or two kind of key tunnels, but particularly in Massachusetts, and also coming out of New York and the like. But there's very few tunnels generally, compared with European systems. And another aspect of it is that there was always open coaches. These were different. There was compartments in European railroads that's which were separated, so you had six or eight people per compartment with its own door. In America, that wasn't really possible, because the distances to be traveled were quite big straight away, and so you needed access to some sort of toilet facility. So they always had open coaches, which is quite interesting. It kind of fostered a kind of feeling of traveling together. So, and the trains were had stronger locomotives, with cow catchers, in other words, cow killers at the front. So, which they didn't have in Europe, because the railroads were not fenced in. So there were several ways in which they were different from the European railroads.
That's a great summary. So this being a necessary tool, it was also necessary for farms and all the factories that were sprouting up all over the country to send their goods to market, either to cities or abroad. One of the most famous political fights of this era that started at the state level and eventually moved up to the federal level was, I guess you'd call them the rate wars, where a lot of customers of railroads complained that railroad companies engaged in favoritism, or they charged them too much. What, if any, justice was there to this complaint?
Oh, absolutely. There was some. I mean, there was constant battles all over different on different railroads, and it was a real point of contention. And this is where your kind of description of the hated railways begins to get into it. So I think you can describe that as at the beginning, the railroads would serve particular localities. They were largely beneficial. People kind of, gained a lot from them, and appreciated them. But as we move on, particularly after the Civil War period, the railways then, as established monopolies, who are then quite profitable because they have a big captive audience. There's no other way of getting around it, I've said. Then start to exploit their monopoly situation. There is no regulator at this point in time. There is one that emerges, the Interstate Commerce Commission emerges later. But at this stage, there's no real regulation. There's nothing to stop them kind of exploiting, particularly farmers who are entirely dependent on that. If you've got fields that are on a railroad line and you're producing, hundreds of times the amount of corn or whatever that you can use yourself, and you're only dependent on kind of selling it to market, then the cost of transferring it along to the market is obviously extremely important to you. And if the railroad companies kind of exploit that, they are going to cause enormous financial difficulty for those particular farmers. So that was one of the ways in which they became, there was a lot of hostility engendered by the railways from the people. There was a couple of other aspects that coincided with this. First of all, there's the creation of trade unions, begin again 1870s, 1880s, more 1880s. They begin to form trade unions, but of course, at the beginning, these are resisted very strongly. But people's sympathy is largely with the trade unions because these people are people in the community. They're people who are working hard in jobs. Their pay isn't particularly wonderful. Again, there probably aren't many other employers around, so they're dependent on the railroad for those jobs. By and large, they have the people's sympathy. So we get the big Pullman strike, where he essentially locks out his workers. It then becomes a kind of nationwide strike. This is a bit later in your period, 1880, late 1880s, 1890s, but nevertheless, is one of the reasons for hostility towards the railroads generally. And then the third is the existence of these very, very rich people, the Vanderbilts and the Jay Goulds and those people who own large numbers of railroad companies. There's a big consolidation that takes place in the 80s and 90s. With the creation of very big companies, they eat up kind of smaller railroads. There's still a lot of railroads, but these big companies assume a kind of quite a dominant position. The owners live in fantastic luxury. They go round on their own trains, of course. They often have their own carriages. Jay Gould famously used to have a carriage with a cow in it because he had a delicate stomach. And he would only drink liquids, milk from a particular cow that apparently was the only one that could supply his that would kind of satisfy his needs in terms of drink because without giving him terrible stomach cramps or whatever. And similarly, the other big railway moguls went round. In these massively bejeweled carriages of their wealth, really in a way that maybe people in Cadillacs did kind of 50 or 100 years later. And they were there, so there was a combination of these three factors: the existence of these very rich people, the sympathy that people had with the workers. And the consolidation of the companies, into much bigger entities, headed by these somewhat unpopular people. That all led to a change in attitude, and ultimately the creation of the intercity state, the Interstate Commerce Commission, which began to regulate the railways and began to impose maximum charges on them for carrying goods and that sort of thing. So it did lead to state involvement.
So that brings us naturally to the next question, because in your book, you note that perhaps the Interstate Commerce Commission was born of good intentions, but that it often had a very harmful effect on railway companies, that it prevented them from making the kind of money they needed to improve their rolling stock or their rails or to improve their technology. A, why did this happen? And B, were there existing regulatory models in the world that might have been a better fit?
Well, to be fair to them, they had a very difficult job. And of course, the job changed. Not so much in the period you're considering, but it did change as, well, particularly maybe in the first decade of the 1900s, it changed because we get cars and what you call trolleys kind of beginning to rival the railroads, and so they face competition for the first time, and therefore the regulation should have adapted to that. And as you suggest, the regulatory framework was clunky, as it often is. I mean, this is repeated with the tech companies today, with the oil companies kind of in the period between the period you're looking at and the present day. Wherever these big companies emerge, you then get the government's correct desire to regulate them, but then you get into the difficulties, the nitty-gritty of how to regulate them while still stimulating enterprise, and not allowing them to make super profits, and yet, where really they're exploiting their monopoly position, but allowing them to make enough profit in to enable them to keep on investing. Very difficult balancing act. And in the early days of the commission, they did quite well in kind of ensuring that some of the exploitation by the railroad companies was controlled and reined back on. But then they really forgot the fact, or ignored the fact, that these companies were beginning to face competition. And they should have then kind of somewhat loosened the reins. And indeed, I mean, outside the period that you're covering, so by the 1930s and from then on, they're definitely flogging a dead horse, where one of the reasons that America's ended up with such a dysfunctional a passenger rail system, where basically passenger rail barely exists apart from in the eastern corridor and a bit in the west, and a few other rail lines, but essentially, they have tourist tracks. Tourist trains, Amtrak tourist trains around the country, but they don't really count as a proper railroad service. So you really have that the commission did contribute towards the speed with which the passenger railways were killed off in America. And if there'd been kind of fleet of foot regulation and better regulation, that might have enabled the small railroad companies to survive. But we're ahead of ourselves here. I mean, you're right in characterizing the regulatory control as too heavy, and sometimes misguided. But I do think you have to recognize what a difficult task that is, the balancing act of trying to rein in kind of uncontrolled capitalism, which tends towards monopolies. I mean, there is, Abby, there is such a similarity today with the tech companies. You kind of look at that. You just think the railroad companies in their heyday of the 1880s, 1890s, no other really rival form of transport completely exploiting the situation. And look at the Facebooks and Microsofts and Googles of today, and or the Standard Oil of the 1950s, and you see exactly the same kind of situation where you have a new technology that is so much better than anything that goes before, or innovates and is so important to the economy, but you've kind of let the cat out of the bag. So railroads were built pretty much kind of where companies wanted them to be built, just as the tech companies really created whatever products they wanted to create without any control. And that needs reining back today, just as the rail companies had to be reined back in the 1880s and 90s. But it's inevitable that some of that regulation got things wrong.
Speaking of things that got me, question of how the government can deal with such an important infrastructure project. One of the things you mentioned at the end of our period is how, because railroads were not able to invest in modernizing their stock and they were barred by law from really working together, that led to some real problems for the United States in the First World War when they had to transport millions upon millions of soldiers and support people in order to get to Europe. And you mentioned that the ultimate solution was that the railroads were nationalized, and that helped to resolve some of the problem. So my question is this: why was it ever seriously considered that America would retain that nationalization, or did everybody understand that this is just an emergency measure, and once the war is over, everything goes back to normal?
Very, very good and interesting question. Yes, I mean to help your listeners, the railroads were nationalized when America went into the war because there were fantastic inefficiencies about the system. There were too many wagons in one place and not in another. They were owned by particular companies that didn't want them used for particular purposes, and this was mirrored, in fact, by what happened in the Civil War, where the North was greatly helped by the fact that they took their railways under control, and essentially ran the railways as a kind of united force. Whereas in the South, that really went against their ethos of their political and commercial ethos. So they didn't nationalize their rail network and suffered as a result. Their rail network was much worse anyway. So I think the lesson, there obviously some people had noticed the lessons of this, and realized quickly that in order to get all those troops to the port and all the material in particular to the ports with the maximum efficiency, somebody had to take control. And the only organization able to take control would of course be government, and so they essentially ran the railroads for those couple of years between America entering the war and their ultimate victory, and they nearly did that again in the Second World War. Although the railroads then realized this was a real threat, and as you suggest, that might have ended up being nationalized permanently. I think that notion of nationalizing the railways permanently after the First World War was only a fleeting thought, because I think it's important to look at the ethos of America here and its traditional kind of hostility to the notion of big government. They don't like big corporations, but they don't like big government even more than they dislike big corporations. And so the idea that you would have ended up with a nationalized rail network, I think, would have been seen as a socialism, or certainly kind of not a very un-American activity, as it were. And it would have been strongly resisted, because the railroads were protested largely, and they were still largely viable, which they weren't at the end of the Second World War. They were not viable then, particularly passenger railways. But in the end of the First World War, they were largely profitable and viable. Interestingly enough, in the UK, we also looked at nationalizing the railways, and we came to a compromise. We in 1923 we consolidated all the different railway companies into four, but they remained private. Whereas in America, essentially they returned. There was more consolidation, but they returned the railways to the companies that had owned them and kind of let them get on with it. As I say, it would have been very unlikely that they would have retained them in as a federally run organization.
That's a great way. That's a great point to end off. I thought I might ask you. You told me before we began this conversation that you are coming out with a book on American and British railmen who helped win the Second World War. Maybe you could tell my listeners about that.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, it's a book I'm most excited about of all the books I've written, and I have written about 20 books, which viewers of this would be able to see behind me. And I'm so excited about this because the book's called The Liberation Line, and it tells the story of the 30,000 American railroad men, and they were largely railroad men who were enlisted in railroad battalions sponsored by particular railroad companies, like the Chesapeake or the New York Central or whatever, Pennsylvania, and some 10,000 British Royal Engineers. And they were sent over very soon after D-Day, which was the 6th of June 1944, which was the invasion force across northwestern Europe, a joint invasion force of Brits and Americans. And these guys were sent over with a specific task to rebuild the railways, which were absolutely essential to keep the supply lines going. Indeed, something like two-thirds of material was carried by the railroads. So without them, progress further eastwards as they kind of moved through France and into Belgium, Holland, and Germany would have been impeded greatly if they hadn't had the railroads behind them. Oddly enough, the story of these guys who rebuilt railways under great pressure, sometimes getting killed by strafing aircraft or whatever, snipers, has never been told. These are the forgotten men of the Second World War because somehow nobody looks at the supply lines. We all look at the guys at the front line kind of shooting and whatever, and we don't look at the guys just behind kind of keeping them going. And there's a central story in my book, which is that General Patton, who takes over the Third Army and starts to move westwards, sorry, eastwards in August 1944. And he wants to get to Paris quickly. And he gets to Le Mans, which is about 150 miles from Paris. But he's run over his supply line. He's gone ahead, too far ahead of it. And he orders the rebuilding of a railroad to service Le Mans to enable him to continue to Paris. And they rebuild this railroad, which is really a rural railroad because the main line has been blown up through Normandy in 3 days. And they rebuild 135 miles of line with 10,000 men in 3 days. And they rebuild this railroad, which had been destroyed by the Resistance and by Allied bombing, and get the trains going. And he gets his 30 trains full of fuel to enable him to get to Paris. Now, I tell that story in the book. It's a story that I discovered in one very obscure railroad magazine, which I only found out because they happened to mention my name. So Google Alerts told me about it. And it's the central story, and it's an amazing story. And so I hope all your listeners, I'm sorry to have rambled on about it, but I'm very enthusiastic about this book. And I hope all your listeners and viewers will buy it when it comes out on the 21st of May, called The Liberation Line.
I very much hope so. It sounds fascinating. Christian, thank you very much for coming on. It's been a pleasure. I'd like to once again remind my listeners that you can listen to this podcast on Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, and YouTube, and you can support the podcast on Patreon. See you all next time at Avi's Conversational Corner.